Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. I'm Doug McVeigh. I'm joined by other members of the Prison Pipeline Collective, Emma Lugo, Karen James, and Adam Carpinelli. It's the end of 2021, at last. And on this edition of Prison Pipeline, we look back at the old year as it finally starts to recede into the distance and then look ahead just in time to see 2022 looming in front of us like a bridge abutment. So let's turn things over first to Adam Carpinelli.
Hi, good evening, folks. Happy holidays. Happy New Year's. And thanks again for everybody who's been supporting our show for many years, including all our excellent, amazing hosts for this program too. And I really appreciate y'all. And, you know, we always talk about giving our shouts out to the prisoners, all the people locked up in detention centers. And as we continue fighting against ICE and the political prison industrial complex, we have to also acknowledge a lot of people who have really given their lives for this movement. I know Emma's going to kind of relate a lot of things to that tonight too, but specifically talking about some folks who have passed away recently, who were from the whole milieu of U.S. held long-term political prisoners. And one of those people who I just wanted to just talk about, and it's very recent. I'm familiar with the family over years, supporting him, Russell Maroon Schoetz. Passed away just on December 17th. And he was sentenced in 1970 to a life sentence. He did live out his last days outside, which is great. And just to give a little bit of, you know, context, you know, about what happened, but he's again, a long-term U.S. held political prisoner. He was part of the Black Panther Party. And from there he went underground with the Black Liberation Army, which was a splinter from the BPP. And so he had been inside for over 50 years. As I always mention, this is almost more time than almost anybody has done as a political prisoner internationally, including people like Nelson Mandela, who people are more familiar with those cases, unfortunately, because people don't really understand the importance of this in the United States as well. And so he was in solitary confinement for some time after winning a civil suit against the DOC. And from there, he started having issues with prostate cancer that was diagnosed in 2019 and survived throughout 12 rounds of chemotherapy before he was approved to get surgery that happened. And so, you know, the story goes on in a sense, but I think the point is, and the take home too, is the importance of all the work that grassroots organizations do out there, the kind of people that we have on the show, the kind of people who are members of our Prison Pipeline Collective who really care about these things or are working around it. So the importance, again, of dealing with people's health inside, and especially for aging prisoners. And in this case, again, somebody who gave his life to that movement. And there's been many more. And we do hope that for 2022, inshallah, that more people will be released who, again, come from these old movements, these old grassroots movements from the 60s and 70s, Black Panther Party and American Indian Movement and so on and so forth. So I always like to say free them all, free all political prisoners, free Mumia, free Leonard Peltier. And again, I really appreciate everybody on the show. And again, I know Emma was going to really talk kind of relating to this about the kind of repression that happens to our movements when we do come out and we speak our minds and fight against mass incarceration, deportation, the racist, murderous police force and all that. So again, I just appreciate, doing the show with y'all. And of course, very much appreciate KBOO too. So, looking forward to seeing everybody next year.
Hi, this is Emma Lugo, co-producer here at Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. And I'm kind of following on what Adam was just talking about. I just wanted to talk for a few minutes about what's been going on with the racial justice movement, the backlash against the racial justice movement in the press lately, and how the messaging that the corporate media is trying to push right now is basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to turn back the gains that were made in the movement over the last 2 years. So last month here in KBOO, we had the transgender vigil. Commissioner Hardesty came and spoke at the vigil. And in addition to talking about how moved she was at, like, you know, the stories of all the people who had died that we were commemorating, she also talked about how there's been this just incredible backlash against her, against women of color here in Portland, against people of color, and against the movement that's, you know, been happening the last 2 years. And, you know, so I want to, like, first, like, step back and look at the numbers. What is the corporate media telling us and what's really going on? So let's start with the numbers. The numbers are that the corporate media keeps on talking about how the Portland Police Bureau is down to 784 officers. And that's as many officers as it had in, like, the 1970s. But what they're not talking about is that the reason that the racial justice movement put so much pressure on the police is because of the historic role the police have played in both policing and repressing communities of color and communities of poor people. Because the police use the power that they have to repress and intimidate people, especially in communities of color and communities of, like, poor people. And part of what this movement was about saying, I mean, just part of it, it's been about so many things. I mean, it's been about educating everyone about the issues that our society has tried to make invisible and has tried to repress ever since, you know, 1592 or whenever. But this movement has also been about looking at the root causes of what's really going on in our culture and how racism perpetuates systems of dominance and oppression in our culture and of white supremacy. So the racial justice movement is still a movement that we want to defund the police. We want to transform what community safety means in our city. And the popular press right now is every day there's coverage of, you know, increases in gun violence, increases in reports of crime. And it has been it's been a bad year. I mean, a lot of people have died, but the people who have died and the victims are part of a much larger process that we have to look at as a culture, as a society. What does it mean when we live in a country where our schools are chronically underfunded, where communities of color's education systems are chronically underfunded, where there are not social support systems in place to support all kinds of communities here in Portland, where people have to work, you know, two or three jobs, be away from their family, be away from their kids, and still, you know, barely have enough to get by? I mean, we have to think about the bigger picture. And also, what do our laws do? What kind of laws do we have? Every kind of issue that we really need to look at, that really, what about, you know, gun ownership? I mean, if we live in a country where it's so easy to get guns that there's more guns than there are people, what role does that play in what's going on? So basically what, you know, just what I want to say is that there's been this backlash against this movement. And this movement was rooted in not only, like, making Americans aware of how intimidated and how fearful people feel in this country of the police. I mean, especially people of color and communities of color, how the police have been used historically, day after day, year after year, generation after generation, to keep people of color down, to keep working poor people down, to control the population, and, you know, to perpetuate some of the cruelest aspects of this culture, and how you look at that symbol of what a police person is from, like, seven different ways till Sunday, depending on where you're looking. You know, police are not necessarily heroes, saviors, community peacekeepers. Police are just as much a part of the problem. And we can't put more people on the street, more police on the street, just to make everybody else feel safe. the authority that the police represent, especially in communities of color, is an authority of white supremacy. It's just the perpetuation of everything that white supremacy represents. And what we need to do is we need to continue to support our movement. You know, we need to support the people that stand for us. Joanne Hardesty, she was from KBOO before she got on the city council, this popular movement that is doing amazing things right now. And it's going to take a while. I mean, it's not going to just happen overnight, but we've got to give it the time that it needs to really grow. So that's basically what I wanted to say. Like in the last year, that's really what I've seen the most. This backlash that's going on right now in the media, where they're basically trying to undo all the messaging of the racial justice movement in order to prepare us for like increases of 200, 300 police officers in Portland and more money for the police, you know, a return to business as usual rather than true transformational change.
One good thing that came out of last year was that Portland adopted a Portland Street Response to take that piece away from the Portland police. And you're reminding me of a show that I did this year about Terrell Johnson, killed by the Portland police. The city had to pay a $600,000 settlement to his family, and he was in a mental health crisis. And we're talking about BIPOC and people of color, but people with mental illness are being shot down on the streets also. So the Portland response team that they adopted, it's just people going around and helping people who are homeless, who are in crisis on the streets, so they don't get shot down by the police. Joanne, Adam, you talked about people that we lost this year. I also want to mention Patty Katz, someone from the Portland area who we lost this year also. Patty was she was just a life force here in our community. She worked with Partnership for Safety and Justice. She worked with Oregon Cure. She started with a friend, Hands Across the Bridge. It's an annual event in solidarity and support of addiction recovery. And people would line up across I-5 from Oregon to Washington in solidarity. And these were people who were all in recovery, celebrating their recovery. And Patty was instrumental in helping pass the Ban the Box law. She was just such a wonderful person that gave so much of herself, and she'll be sorely missed. And I want to talk about three bills that did not pass the Oregon legislature last year. And I want to talk about these bills because in 2022, the Oregon legislature will be meeting, but they will be meeting only very shortly, only for 35 days. They will convene on February 1st, and the session will be done by March 7th. So I hope that our listeners will call their legislators about these bills. Adam, you talked about compassionate release of prisoners, and this is one of the bills that did not pass last year. During COVID, Oregon Governor Brown did commute some people were released from prison under compassionate release, but very few. And it took forever for her to do this. Now, there is a system in place in Oregon for compassionate release, but it's hardly ever used. And plus, they're not medical professionals who review these medical conditions of these prisoners. So this compassionate release bill, which will come before the Oregon legislature again in 2022, which has a really good chance of passing this next year, it would establish a medical release advisory committee. And it would be a group of actual medical professionals who will review at least 5 cases a month. And they'll review the person's medical condition and then refer it to the parole board for release. Now, Measure 11 convictions cannot be eligible for release. This is why there are so many people aging in our prison system here in Oregon. And it's because of Measure 11. These mandatory, god-awful, long, you know, decades-long sentencing. So there's a lot of adults in custody in the Oregon prison system who have serious health problems. So this is one bill that will pass in 2022, hopefully. Another bill is the Voting Rights Restoration Bill. And this bill would allow adults in custody to vote while incarcerated. This did not pass in 2021, and it has a good chance of passing in 2022. So this would help adults in custody keep connected to their community while they're in prison. In Oregon, once they are released from prison, they do have the right to regain their right to vote. So that's another bill that hopefully will pass in 2022. And the other is the compensation bill. And this bill will give adults in custody the right to bring a claim against the state for wrongful conviction. In Oregon, you know, if you're exonerated, if you're found that you did not commit the crime and you serve time in prison, you leave prison and you have no income, you have no housing, no transportation, no medical care, or no psychological counseling. And this would allow people to get some funding for wrongful conviction. And Oregon is one of the few states that does not compensate wrongful convictions. So contact your legislature. You'll have to do this in January. And just remember, voting rights restoration, compassionate release, and compensation for wrongful convictions. And you can go to OregonLegislature.gov to find your legislator, but call them as soon as possible and let them know that you support this legislation. Doug, what do you have on your slate?
I was sitting through I attended the news conference on that voter right restoration bill as well. And on the one hand, you know, there is an argument that gets made that that it's a big ask and that there are other more pressing concerns in terms of voting rights. And so that whether that should be at the forefront of the demands is it's questionable. And I mentioned that by way of illustration, because I think that kind of argument is really garbage. And you know, I've been slow to realize a lot of these things, I'll confess. And so the notion of, you know, actually asking for what we want and being out front about that and not backing away because it's a controversial thing. Things like just interviewing someone about opioid-assisted treatment within prisons and things like methadone, buprenorphine. In a lot of jurisdictions, that's not available. In fact, people might be on, you know, treatment, successfully on treatment out there, but for some reason they commit a violation of some kind, and so they're put back inside, and they're going to be off that treatment when they go back inside. You can't do that when you're inside. So how screwed up that is, because that creates then demand for an illegal drug within prisons, because people don't switch on and off their dependence just because they get incarcerated. That's not really how it works. It's a big thing, you know, in a way, because we don't have adequate access to methadone and buprenorphine and other substitution treatment out here in the, you know, in the non-incarcerated world. So asking for it within prisons may seem like something of a big ask, but it's really not, because it's what's flipping needed. So it's a sort of a confessional thing for me this year, is working more on some of these things, of realizing that we have to step out of the what's acceptable to the liberals and to the Democrats who have super majorities in the state of Oregon in both sides of the legislature and the governor's mansion, and yet they can't pass any significant criminal justice reform. Why is that? And so, you know, I think we have to, you know, stop. I'm done playing nice. Opioid substitution treatment's an absolute necessity. I was talking to somebody about that. And one of the other things, of course, that's a common thing in a number of European nations. Another thing that's done in some European nations is that people who are inside are given the right to vote, which is this law that we have that you're talking about here. That's a human right, because franchise should not go away just because someone has been convicted of some kind of a crime. That's not how it should work. People are still people, even when they're inside a prison. I mean, that's one of the other things I'll be working on, really, is the humanization of people who are within prison or people who have been convicted of some kind of a crime, because they're people. At the end of the day, at the start, they're always people. And it's when we forget about that and call them any other kind of thing that that it becomes much easier to abuse and brutalize them. And I mean, there's another thing they do in many European nations, and that's have an actual syringe service program within a prison, because drug use doesn't stop just because people are inside. Neither does injection drug use stop just because people are inside prison walls, which in many ways should be a really strong argument to legalize and provide a safe supply and or at least decriminalize out here in the regular world. And that's another thing we'll be looking at, is the broader decriminalization of people who use drugs, which includes things like supervised consumption sites, which we've been trying to get in Portland, trying to get in Seattle, trying to get in a lot of places. And New York City has finally authorized two locations to start providing that vital service. They've saved a number of lives already in the last few weeks, in a time when we have more than 100,000 people dying of overdose within a 12-month period in the U.S., we're way past the time we should be doing this stuff. So, you know, things like that we'll be looking at, because people who use drugs, at the end of the day, we can shorten that, as my friend Sean Shelley says, we can shorten that to just people. Looking ahead, that's what I think I'll be looking at over the next few.
There were a number of other bills that passed during the 2021 Oregon legislative session, including a number of police reform bills. And there were a few bills that impacted youth expungement. A bill passed that will expunge records for some juvenile convictions. Another bill that passed that affected youth was to prevent coercion by police of youth during interviews.
That's a really big deal. Yeah. I mean, the police are trained to lie. They're trained to manipulate to get whatever story they want. So, yeah, that's really big.
There were a number of police reform bills that passed in 2021 here in Oregon.
It's been a really challenging year. I mean, it's really been a challenging year, because it's like, can America handle change? Can it handle a culture that isn't just based on white supremacy, but is actually based on acknowledging the realities, the complex realities of the implications of racism and oppression in our country? Are we willing to like look at our 400-year history and try to do things differently? Now's when we start the moment of truth.
So what can people do about this request for 300 more police, 300 more police on the streets of Portland? What can people do? Contact their city commissioners, contact Mayor Wheeler. What can they do?
I mean, actually, the PPB's union rep, is it Daryl Turner, who used to be the PPB president? And now he's like this advocate who, I mean, he basically wants to double the size of the PPB. But right now, there isn't any significant motion in city council, which is good. But we need to continue to support our city councilors who, you know, have been listening over these many years and are willing to hold the line. I mean, we can't give in to fear, and we can't give in to a lack of understanding of where we're at in this moment.
And what about the call to defund the police? There's so much confusion around that issue. Do we want to defund the police totally, or are we saying take the funding from the police budget and instead fund programs and services like the Portland Street Response and other programs?
We're saying that the police are not the answer to community safety. I mean, they're just not. We have to look at the root causes. That's what we're really saying. I mean, there's always going to be a need for protection in a community, but the police are not the answer. I mean, the police are this bad idea that has just gone totally off the rails, and we need something different. You know, the history of the police has proven that we have to move on.
I just thought it was interesting to mention, but I ended up on a website because I was interviewed by People for Portland. And initially my understanding was that we were talking about housing, and that was their interest, is talking about housing. That was my understanding when I talked to them. And that's why I interviewed with them around houseless advocacy programs that are happening in Portland, and with the idea of, you know, how that would hold city officials accountable, you know, for this issue, and how they're not really doing anything. And it turns out that I had to ask them to get off the website because when I saw the real platform, you know, when I really saw the transparency there, they were also lobbying basically for more police. And so, and when I talked to them about it, you know, I said that I didn't think that was definitely not a solution. That wasn't something that, you know, when I had talked to them about houseless advocacy, that was a factor. And yet they'll still claim that, according to their own sources, talking to people in the unhoused community and other people in the community, that it is a necessary measure. And, you know, and I just strongly urge anyone, you know, thinking like that, including them, to really think outside the box on that one, and to really critically understand the role of law enforcement, as Emma has also explained. So I just wanted to chime in with that, because that was another one of these kind of weird things coming up in the community, and folks asking me, you know, why I was on this website and things of that nature, once their kind of platform was really kind of more transparent. And so that just shows, again, the problem with public support, lack of critical thinking within the community as well on that particular matter. And you have been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Special thanks to our lovely Prison Pipeline Collective members, Emma Lugo, Karen James, and Doug McVeigh. I'm Adam Carpinelli. Free them all.